Chapter 4. What are dreams? A random sequence of scenes, trivial or tragic, viatic or static, fantastic or familiar, featuring more or less plausible events patched up with grotesque details and recasting dead people in new settings. In reviewing the more or less memorable dreams I have had during the last 9 decades, I can classify them by subject matter into several categories, among which 2 surpass the others in generic distinctiveness. There are the professional dreams and there are the erotic ones. In my 20s, the first kind occurred about as frequently as the second, and both had their introductory counterparts. Insomnia is conditioned either by the overflow of 10 hours of vocational work, or by the memory of artists that a thorn in my day had maddeningly revived. After work, I battled against the might of the mindset, the stream of composition, the force of the phrase demanding to be formed could not be stopped for hours of darkness and discomfort, and when some result had been achieved, the current still hummed on behind the wall, even if I locked up my brain by an act of self-hypnosis. Plain will or pill could no longer help, within some other image or meditation. But not artists, not Ada, for that would mean drowning in a cataract of worse wakefulness, with rage and regret, desire and despair sweeping me into an abyss where sheer physical extenuation stunned me at last with sleep. In the professional dreams that especially obsessed me when I worked on my earliest fiction, and pleaded abjectly with a very frail muse, kneeling and wringing my hands, like the dusty-trousered marmalade before his marmalady in Dickens, I might see, for example, that I was correcting galley proofs, but that somehow, the great somehow of dreams, the book had already come out, had come out literally, being proffered to me by a human hand from the waste paper basket in its perfect and dreadfully imperfect stage, with a typo on every page, such as the snide bitterly instead of butterfly, and the meaningless nuclear instead of unclear. Or I would be hurrying to a reading I had to give, would feel exasperated by the sight of the traffic and people blocking my way, and then realize with sudden relief that all I had to do was to strike out the phrase crowded street in my manuscript. What I might designate as skyscape, not skyscrape, as 2/3 of the class will probably take it down, dreams belong to a subdivision of my vocational visions, or perhaps may represent a preface to them. For it was in my early pubescence that hardly a night would pass without some old or recent wake-time impressions establishing a soft, deep link with my still-muted genius. For we are von, rhyming with and indeed signifying von in Marina's W-less deep-voweled Russian pronunciation. The presence or promise of art in that kind of dream would come in the image of an overcast sky with a manifold lining of cloud, a motionless but hopeful white, a hopeless but gliding gray, showing artistic signs of clearing, and presently the glow of a pale sun grew through the leaner layer only to be recowled by the scud, for I was not yet ready. Allied to the professional and vocational dreams are dim-doom visions, fatidic sign nightmares, thalamic calamities, menacing riddles. Not infrequently the menace is well concealed, and the innocent incident will turn out to possess, if jotted down and looked up later, the kind of precognitive flavor that Dunn has explained by the action of reverse memory. But for the moment, I am not going to enlarge upon the uncanny element particular to dreams, beyond observing that some law of logic should fix the number of coincidences in a given domain, after which they cease to be coincidences and form instead the living organism of a new truth. "Tell me," says Osberg's little gitana to the Moors, El Motella and Romera, "what is the precise minimum of hairs on a body that allows one to call it hairy?" Between the dim doom and the poignantly sensual, I would place melts of erotic tenderness and heart-rending enchantment, chance frôlements of anonymous girls at vague parties, half-smiles of appeal or submission, forerunners or echoes of the agonizing dreams of regret when series of receding adas faded away in silent reproach, and tears, even hotter than those I would shed in waking life, shook and scalded poor Van, and were remembered at odd moments for days and weeks. Van's sexual dreams are embarrassing to describe in a family chronicle that the very young may perhaps read after a very old man's death. Two samples, more or less euphemistically worded, should suffice. In an intricate arrangement of thematic recollections and automatic phantasmata, Aqua, impersonating Marina, or Marina made up to look like Aqua, arrives to inform Van joyfully that Ada has just been delivered of a girl child whom he is about to know carnally on a hard garden bench while underneath a nearby pine his father, or his dress-coated mother, is trying to make a transatlantic call for an ambulance to be sent from Vence at once. Another dream, recurring in its basic, unmentionable form since 1888 and well into this century, contained an essentially triple and, in a way, trebadic idea. Bad Ada and Lewd Lucette had found a ripe, very ripe ear of Indian corn. Ada held it at both ends as if it were a mouth organ, and now it was an organ, and she moved her parted lips along it, varnishing its shaft, and while she was making it trill and moan, Lucette's mouth engulfed its extremity. The two sisters' avid, lovely young faces were now close together, doleful and wistful in their slow, almost languid play, their tongues meeting in flicks of fire and curling back again, their tumbled hair, red bronze and black bronze, delightfully commingling, and their sleek hindquarters lifted high as they slaked their thirst in the pool of his blood. I have some notes here on the general character of dreams. One puzzling feature is the multitude of perfect strangers with clear features but never seen again, accompanying, meeting, welcoming me, pestering me with long, tedious tales about other strangers, all this in localities familiar to me, and in the midst of people, deceased or living, whom I knew well. Or the curious tricks of an agent of Kronos, a very exact clock-time awareness with all the pangs, possibly full bladder pangs in disguise, of not getting somewhere in time, and with that clock hand before me, numerically meaningful, mechanically plausible, but combined, and that is the curious part, with an extremely hazy, hardly existing passing of time feeling. This theme I will also reserve for a later chapter. All dreams are affected by the experiences and impressions of the present as well as by memories of childhood. All reflect in images or sensations a draft, a light, a rich meal, or a grave internal disorder. Perhaps the most typical trait of practically all dreams, unimportant or portentous, and this despite the presence in stretches or patches of fairly logical, within special limits, cogitation and awareness, often absurd, of dream past events, should be understood by my students as a dismal weakening of the intellectual faculties of the dreamer, who is not really shocked to run into a long-dead friend. At his best, the dreamer wears semi-opaque blinkers. At his worst, he's an imbecile. The class, 1891, 1892, 1893, 1894, etc., will carefully note, rustle of blue books, that, owing to their very nature, to that mental mediocrity and bumble, dreams cannot yield any semblance of morality or symbol or allegory or Greek myth unless, naturally, the dreamer is a Greek or a mythicist. Metamorphoses in dreams are as common as metaphors in poetry. A writer who likens, say, the fact of imagination's weakening less rapidly than memory to the lead of a pencil getting used up more slowly than its erasing end is comparing two real, concrete, existing things. Do you want me to repeat that? Cries of yes, yes. Well, the pencil I'm holding is still conveniently long, though it has served me a lot, but its rubber cap is practically erased by the very action it has been performing too many times. My imagination is still strong and serviceable, but my memory is getting shorter and shorter. I compare that real experience to the condition of this real, commonplace object. Neither is a symbol of the other. Similarly, when a tea shop humorist says that a little conical titbit with a comical cherry on top resembles this or that, titters in the audience, he is turning a pink cake into a pink breast, tempestuous laughter, in a fraise-like frill or frilled phrase. Silence. Both objects are real. They are not interchangeable. Not tokens of something else, say, of Walter Raleigh's decapitated trunk still topped by the image of his wet nurse. One lone chuckle. Now the mistake, the lewd, ludicrous, and vulgar mistake of the Signy Mon Dieu analysts consists in their regarding a real object, a pompon, say, or a pumpkin, actually seen in a dream by the patient, as a significant abstraction of the real object, as a bumpkin's bonbon, or one half of the bust, if you see what I mean. Scattered giggles. There can be no emblem or parable in a village idiot's hallucinations or in last night's dream of any of us in this hall. In those random visions, nothing, underscore nothing, grating sound of horizontal strokes, can be construed as allowing itself to be deciphered by a witch doctor who can then cure a madman or give comfort to a killer by laying the blame on a too fond, too fiendish, or too indifferent parent. Secret festerings that the foster quack feigns to heal by expensive confession fests. Laughter and applause.